Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Hey, J. Michael Michael here, and welcome to 2019. And if you're like me, you love talk radio, but you just can't find anything worth listening to on the AM dial. Then how about this? How about you tune into LA Talk Radio? See, LA Talk Radio is a .com and has it all, from sports to music to self-help to just about anything, including talk. So right now, we have the new writer's favorite show, The Writer's Block. Sit back, pour some more scotch, enjoy it, because it all starts right now.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Bob Brill, only on LA Talk Radio.
I can tell by the look on your face, you are totally blown.
No way. Yeah, 2 weeks in a row.
I know. I got you 2 weeks in a row.
You got me. Yeah,
I have. That is actually Flight to Compound from Zero Dark Thirty.
Oh, really?
Mm. You know,
I'm sorry, it's a film I didn't see.
I figured, what is another appropriate song for appropriate writer that we have sitting in the studio tonight?
You got it.
Here. There's not a lot of music to it. It's mostly just like drums and bass. Yeah. But hey, good piece of music if you catch the entire soundtrack. Not bad. Hey, this is LA Talk Radio. You're listening to The Writer's Block. I am Jim Christina, your host, in studio tonight with Bob Brill.
Hey,
and on the line with our lovely, qualified, over-radioed co-host, Bobby Jean Bell.
Qualified. Solidified.
She's got like talk shows on every day now, almost.
No.
Talkified.
3 on Thursday, 1 on Saturday.
Is it 3 now on Thursdays?
3 on Saturdays and 1 on, 3 on Thursday. And what day is it?
This is Thursday.
My gosh, Bobby.
For those that don't know, Southern California has been deluged in rain since Monday. We have had, this morning we had thunder showers up in Simi. It was like boom, boom.
The last 4 days we had a foot of rain.
Oh, easily.
Foot.
What about all the burn areas?
It's everybody's complaining because a lot of them are sliding down onto the freeway.
Hollywood Hills had a few homes.
Yeah.
Yellow tag.
Yeah. It's been an interesting time in the old SoCal.
Yeah, it's time to get out the boat.
Yeah. But the freeways were like pretty clear tonight. Yeah. So we shot in here.
It just stopped, you know?
Yeah.
So there was no rain on the roads.
It quit and the roads dried up and I was dry paving all the way in from Simi. So I was pretty happy. And no traffic.
I made it record time.
Yeah. Yes, you did. Well, yeah.
I was a half hour.
I'm always wondering if you're going to make it at all because of the traffic. Hey, we have a guest tonight. It's like I said, he's in studio with us, and the guy is like a phenomenal writer, but he's done so much. I mean, the guy is just like, okay, here's his bio. He's a native of Los Angeles. Good for you. Not many of those around anymore. Has lived in Israel, traveled extensively through Lebanon, Syria, and Egypt. At the age of 21, he was sent on a mission into the Soviet Union to smuggle a dissident's manuscript on microfilm to London. His first trip was a success. On his second trip, however, he transferred a manuscript to the Dutch ambassador inside his Moscow embassy, and a week later, he was arrested. Wow, that's cool.
That's cool.
Fortunately, I wasn't arrested for that.
Right, but he's in the studio.
That was helpful.
He was arrested in Ukraine and interrogated for 2 days there and then 2 days in Moscow before being expelled from the USSR. Are you still in persona non grata?
You know, the Damascus cover, which came out,
right,
which is the one that
right.
about 4 years after this, was sold to a lot of countries, but was sold to a publisher at that time in Yugoslavia.
Oh, really?
It was agreed to be published. They sent it to the Central Committee. It was put on, it was declined. It was put on the official Eastern European blacklist. And all copies in Yugoslavia of the galleys were confiscated.
Wow,
so I presume that had to do with the arrest and not the book.
Was Tito still around at that point?
I don't know. I don't remember. That would be 77.
No, I think he was dead by then. I think he died early 70s. Or he's probably assassinated. Bobby, you still there?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm here.
We're just,
yes, I'm here.
Oh, chocolate wine. See, Bob? You're right.
Yep.
Bobby just says, I mean, she drinks coffee and Bailey's. I mean,
ooh,
we can't
I'll
see
have
her.
A sip. Oh, what a great
all I got was an empty mug. So
yeah, yeah, all Howard got was an empty mug. Okay, he holds a B.A. in Middle East History from UC Berkeley and an M.A. in Philosophy of Education from UCLA. He is the author of 5 novels. Please welcome to the Writer's Block, Mr. Howard Kaplan. Now, I gave Dawn last week an option. She could have the applause or she could have... We gave you the applause.
Sounds like I got both.
You did. So did Dawn.
Seems like the choice is minimal here.
I'm just absolutely fascinated by your trip through the Soviet Union and being arrested. And like I told you, we're going to talk about that tonight. So let's just get that out of the way.
Okay, I'm here, so...
Yes. Apparently, they didn't hurt you. But you said the captivity was much better than the room service.
Right.
At the hotel.
What I was saying is
maybe you should have played the music back in the USSR.
Probably.
You know, when I was in Russia, I was surprised that they were in early 70s. They were playing Beatle music in the hotels, and I didn't expect not back in the USSR.
Well, they've
but
always been a couple years behind
other types of things. But when they jumped me with a bunch of people in Ukraine. They took us to KGB headquarters in that city, Kharkov, and they had to get a translator. They weren't used to picking up Americans there, so they ended up getting the manager of the hotel. And by the time they got him and they got the interrogators in, it was like midnight, and they asked me a few questions, and I asked to use the bathroom, and they said, well, we'll just send you back to the hotel. And they picked it up in the morning in the hotel, and what you're referring to is what I told you is they handled it very well. I got food whenever I wanted, and it really was better service than in the dining room of the hotel under interrogation.
Don't you love that? That's just, I mean, and here he sits, smiling.
Here I am.
And what was the reason they gave you for picking you up?
Consorting with known hooligans.
Oh, okay.
And then when they interrogated me, I said, you know, they're just, are you not allowed to talk to Soviet citizens? They said, you can talk to Soviet citizens. You can't talk to hooligans.
And dissidents.
And then they made a whole thing saying, like, if you're ignorant of the law and break it, you're still liable.
Right.
Same thing. If I went to the United States and I broke a law and I didn't know it was a law.
Ignorance
so that
is
was
not
kind
an excuse.
Of the, that was the argument.
What was the first thought? And I got to ask you this because we know the time period. What was the first thing that ran through your mind and your body when you got picked up?
It was about 11 o'clock at night. It was very abrupt, meaning they were walking me back to the trolley, some of these dissidents. We turned a corner, and a bunch of guys jumped out. It was so fast, I didn't really have thoughts.
Jumped out of cars? Limos?
No, they were around the corner.
Oh,
they
okay.
just were standing there waiting. And they took the guy next to me, the Russian guy, and threw me up against the wall. But they hit him in the stomach. And at that point, really, maybe I had good parenting, I was more worried about him than me. Because he's a Soviet, and I felt as an American, I'm probably protected, and by virtue of the fact that I wasn't really hurt initially, nobody punched me at that point. They just pushed me up against the wall. I guess that was a harbinger that I probably would be okay.
Did they announce who they were before they did this, or did you?
No, they just, some guys were uniformed, some guys were not, and... It was all very quick. It was dark.
So you realized that they were Russian officials? Or
yes.
KGB
it was
or,
clear that they, yes, never occurred. There was no thing that they might be hooligans or, you know, pickpockets or.
No, because as we know, you can't associate with hooligans.
Right. And I'd already, you know.
Right. Especially in the Soviet Union.
I would have been allowed to talk to those guys, right, if
wow.
they were true hooligans.
Yeah,
right.
That's true.
Right.
Wow.
Well, at that time, Ukraine was still part of the Soviet Union.
Yes. It was no different than being in Moscow.
Right.
So we're talking 73.
72.
So sort of Brezhnev is still around.
Yeah, right? Leonid.
Yeah.
Yeah, there really was a sense that detente was still in the air, mm-hmm. and that likely, I mean, you know, there would be, I was sort of trained that if you get picked up, they're going to threaten you with 15 years imprisonment.
In the gulag.
So, I mean, this is really just tells you how silly I was at this age. They threatened me with 10 years, and I felt slighted. I thought, well, how come the other guys get threatened with 15? You know.
So, why did you do this? I mean, were you contracted with somebody government wise?
I was. Sure, I mean, there are two different questions, two different answers. One is, my mother was a Holocaust survivor. My mother was in Auschwitz, and she was a damaged human being. She went in at 16, near the end of the war, for a year. And I felt always that the world sat a little silent. You know, they didn't bomb the camps. They didn't do anything. So I wasn't going to be silent. And I happened to be in my junior year abroad at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And I had a girl I knew from Hamilton High on Robertson in Los Angeles. And she had a boyfriend who suddenly was recruiting people to go to Moscow on their way back from their junior year abroad. And she brought me into this group. And then we sort of studied and trained one night a week. And they said, whoever is the most competent is going to go in and get the microfilm. So I got the microfilm. And that was my first trip.
Yeah.
And I got it out.
Yeah.
And then I said, let me go back. And I went back the next year, and that's when this stuff happened. So I was there in 71 and 72.
So the second time, did you get more microfilm? Or you,
no, the second time is what Jim had mentioned. They asked me to bring a physical manuscript, pages, to the Dutch embassy. And at that point, they always had KGB or military officers outside all embassies. So you went and showed them your American passport. So the ambassador would not have taken a manuscript on the street or in a home. But inside his own embassy, he would.
Well, sure, that's ground. I mean,
right.
That's their
So
property.
We sat, I had some story that I knew his daughter, and we sat and talked, and I don't remember, we made, you know, some talk about his daughter that I'd never actually met, and the whole time we're writing notes, whatever. I don't actually remember the content of the notes, except for I remember the last one. He wrote on it and said, please be careful, this is not James Bond, and then he burned all the notes. But when I got picked up, let's say a week later, they didn't know about that. It wasn't like they, you know, I was always worried at the last minute they're going to say, after you've denied everything, they say, oh, yeah, by the way, here's a picture of you entering the Dutch embassy. But that didn't happen.
So when you're doing all this, you're not hearing the James Bond theme in the back of your head.
You know, a
I
lot
just
of
have
it,
to ask.
Some of it was like a B movie, and I'm being interrogated. Whenever they didn't like my answer, the phone would ring.
You know, it's amazing that you're the second person we've had in here in the last 3 weeks that his mother was a Holocaust survivor.
Yeah, it's true.
Stan Goldman was here, and he told a story about his mother. Somebody convincing Eichmann to turn a bunch of Jews loose.
They were trying to,
and he did like 4,000 of them
after the war because they knew the war crime trials were coming.
Right,
and they were trying to soften the blow that maybe they could.
And Eichmann was right in the middle of trying to, no, not Eichmann.
No, it wasn't
Himmler.
Himmler,
right in the middle of trying to negotiate with the Allies,
right.
And he turned 4,000 Jewish women free.
Just serendipity.
Yeah.
So what happened to the manuscript that you gave to
the Dutch ambassador? I presume it came out in his. What do you call it? A pouch is, you know.
Yeah.
Diplomatic pouch.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah. I don't actually know what it was.
Oh, I see.
And, you know, I met with, they actually gave it to me in a public bathroom. I met with one of the dissidents, and they met me in a bathroom very near the Dutch embassy.
Gotcha.
So the amount of time I had it was like two blocks.
So you have no idea what.
No, I could still be, you know, in the gulag, you know,
you know,
memorizing the manuscript. I do not know what was.
Yeah,
in
I could still be over there learning to love borscht.
Yeah, it could be. It could have been Obama's borscht or something.
I can't stand beets, but I do like borscht.
But actually, part of my starting to write was inspired by these guys.
Well, that's the next question we're going to ask you, Bobby. Or can I wake you up now?
I'm here. Why do you say that to me? I'm listening rivetedly, looking for an opportunity to jump in and say something.
When you're not here, we don't know how much you've had to drink. No. No, we're only
kidding. Are you going to say the name of Howard's book?
I am. And it's actually his.
Know what we're talking about?
This is your newest book.
Right.
It's called Spy's Gamble.
Right.
And it takes place, let's see, everywhere.
Yeah. Everywhere.
Starts out in D.C.
All my books take place everywhere.
Everywhere. It's focused primarily in the Mideast.
Right.
And we've got Israelis and, golly, Lebanese and Arabs and non-Arabs and, huh?
Palestinians
and white guys and...
I've been to Lebanon a couple of times, once on my own and once with the Israeli army while they were invading.
Uh-huh.
Or they took me on a press junket, you know.
Oh, was that when Sharon?
Yes, in the early 80s.
Right before the massacre at the camps.
Right. And in fact, I wrote a different book called Bullets of Palestine that talks about the massacre of the camps. I like to use real events. In The Spy's Gamble, a lot of those events, one of the readers wrote me and said, I'm not sure the ink is dry on the page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I try to move fictional characters through real events. For example... There was a hit and run, not a hit and run. There was a big Mercedes truck that came off in Jerusalem. There's a place, it's like a southern walking trail, but it overlooks all of Jerusalem. It's really quite beautiful. And major battles were fought there because it's the southern entrance to the city and it's defensive. So they take young soldiers out to talk to them about how strategic the land is. So there was a real event, I think in 2016, where a big truck came up, jumped the sidewalk, plowed into this row of Israeli cadets, they called them, you know, officers in training, as they were getting on a bus, and killed four of them. And initially, it wasn't clear whether it was an accident or intentional, except the driver got farther on, turned around, started backing up to try to hit them again. So how did I describe this? It turns out by running around on the internet, I found CCTV footage of the attack.
Did you really?
And I was able to replicate it. And, you know, there's a lot of myth about Israeli soldiers and Israeli, you know, supermen. It turns out that these young officers in training all froze, virtually all of them. And who ran around and shot the guy? The tour guide.
Wow.
Because they tour guides all carry pistols for these kind of events. But my work shows both sides. That's one of the things that you know, I'm known for. I'm also in the refugee camps looking at what it's like, you know, for seeing monuments inside the refugee camps to everybody who's been killed in clashes with the Israeli soldiers. So I'm as close to possible wanting to replicate how it really looks on the ground.
Yeah. You know,
I remember the attack at the camps when the Israelis, if I remember right, allowed the Lebanese in.
Christians, right.
Yes. And the massacres took place. And if I remember right, it was in September because I remember that month I was doing news at in Fresno. And it was like that month, I kept calling it Black September because there was so much tragedy that month. And this was at the center of it, and there was other stuff around the world.
I believe it was September 82. I'm not, don't hold me to that, but I think it was.
Yeah,
what had happened was the Palestinians had assassinated Bashir Gemayel, who was the Christian leader of Lebanon. Lebanon's about half Christian and half Muslim.
Right, right.
So many of the prime ministers, presidents are Christian. So the intelligence said that the two refugee camps, Sabra and Shatila, were full of PLO terrorists. So the Israelis didn't go in, but you have it exactly right. They lit the sky with, you know, flares.
Mm-hmm.
The Christians went in, and they found all the fighters had left. So they killed women and children and old people. And I, in this other book, this earlier book, Bullets of Palestine, which has the same characters as the Spy's Gamble, I have the main Palestinian character, Ramzi Awad, caught in Sabra, or Shatila, I forget which one, and hiding and surviving the massacres. He's indeed Palestinian.
Hmm. Well, the Spy's Gamble is... I'm going to let you go with this one, Bobby, because we talked about this today.
Howard, this is you're a fascinating writer. This is a part of the world that I really don't know a lot about, and I felt like I was getting an amazing history lesson. Each character, I have a question about how you keep track of your characters, and each character that you introduce to us, you take us back to their youth, and you bring it forward in a number of paragraphs. The character, when you introduce the character, he may have just entered a room and he might be looking at something and musing over something, and he has a thought about something from his past, and then you take us there. Your characters are so rich in the history that you share. I did get confused at times. I had to start taking notes and writing down their names.
Yeah, people have told me that maybe there should be a character list.
If I go back and reread the first like 10 pages of the book after having read it, I'm like, oh, okay, I got who Eli is. Oh, I got, you write a wonderful woman, and I'm sorry, I won't pronounce her name right, T-S-I-P-I.
Right,
tell us about her. She's an amazing woman.
So I'll tell you the truth, as much as I shouldn't admit this. She's an amalgam of a real-life Israeli politician and an old girlfriend that I had.
Wow.
Maybe 75% Israeli politician with that history. And then sometimes I generally work, you know, I wander around a lot. I talk to people. Like, I actually had a date, not with this old girlfriend, with somebody else who's an Israeli here in Los Angeles, who told me the story that I used, which was that her love of her life, her boyfriend, was killed in an accident prior to the Lebanon War, in a training accident. And that just struck me as so ironic. You know, we have all these terrible war deaths all the time, and here she's mourning the death of somebody who was killed in a training accident. And she said it to me so powerfully, and I can't remember exactly how I wrote it, but it was like her body was physically bent for a year.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's how I got that from this Israeli woman whose actual boyfriend had been her high school boyfriend, you know, her first lover, her everything, who was killed in this manner. And it was just so powerful to me the way she described her grief.
Well, I think that's one of the wonderful things about your writing is, as much as you're giving us this political atmosphere and this story, you're giving us history, but these characters are not the least bit cliche. Eli, you know, is and you can talk about him for a moment, but we discover that he's no longer a believer. And you know, you kind of would think that, oh, this would be a man that would be such a strong, you know, believer in Jewish faith. And he's turned away from it. And I thought, wow, that's kind of risky as an author to do that with that character. And yet, as the book moves along, we get that.
Well,
you give us really multidimensional characters.
You know, I try to write sometimes what they say is against type. So Eli, instead of the loner spy who's out in the cold, is a family man.
Yeah.
With kids and, you know, and events he wants to attend in his family that he misses often because he's out in the field doing what he needs to be doing. So that just struck me as something I hadn't actually read before in that way. Mm-hmm. And the faith thing just sort of filled in with that.
I was talking to Jim today, and then I'll be quiet so Bob can jump in here. But Jim and I were talking earlier today, and there were two phrases that just jumped off the page at me, and I've been going back through the book trying to find who said them.
I'm not sure I can remember, but we'll try.
And that may or may not be that important. To me, they were so very timely. One comment that one character says to another is, How do we have uniformity and not be uniform?
Right.
I thought, well, there's a question for the ages. And then another comment, and it might have been Eli, someone is saying, and it might have been a character to Eli, well, don't you have Jewish history? If it wasn't Eli, it was a Jewish character that responded and said, we don't have history, we have memory.
Right. Those are both the same character.
That also really struck me. It's two very powerful comments that you make.
Okay, so the truth is I'm a great thief. Those comments both come from a very close friend of mine.
Ah.
Who actually has that position. He lives in Jerusalem. I'll leave his name out for the moment.
Okay.
And he's a prominent character in the world of education. Friend of mine since 1970, so for really a long. I stay in his home when I'm in Israel, and he stays in my home when he's here. And some people will know those, some of those lines, because he's known. But we sat and talked in his living room in Jerusalem about some of these characters and some of these issues. And even on occasion, if I don't know what his character would say, I would call him up. And I would say, what would you say to this? For example, he walks through the Arab marketplace with an Israeli intelligence officer, this lecturer. And he indeed, this friend of mine, speaks. He has a fabulous position back to Israeli cadets. You can't become an officer in the Israeli army without listening to one of his lectures.
Wow.
And his lecture is, yes, that's part of the it's part of the requirement of officers' training, and part of what he's talking about is pluralism, which isn't so common these days, even in Israel. And this whole idea of we can be not, we don't have to all be the same in order to be unified. In other words, tolerance for diversions, even within Israeli society, because you have a lot of religious, non-religious splits as far as other splits, leftists and rightists, you know, there's Israel is no longer this kind of uniform society it was in the days of Exodus. It just isn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the world. I mean, they, you know, they just got to Trump a little sooner.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, it's ask about a parliamentary government, you know.
Right.
There you go.
The one question I had was regarding when we write, we kind of all imagine ourselves at some point in our books and playing a part in those books. How much of you personally, would you say, or is in your books or even in your characters at some point?
I would say my first book, The Damascus Cover, which is the one that's a feature film now. There, I started that book when I was in my 20s, and I had been at Berkeley in the 60s. Just happened. You know, I applied to college. I went to Berkeley, and then 68 blew up. Yeah. And then I'd been to Russia, and I'd been arrested. So when I was about 24, and I didn't have, you know, a career, I thought I'd better do something. So I started to write a novel. And I felt burnt out and kind of worn out by all these experiences. And I also thought a burnt out 24-year-old would not be vastly sympathetic to people. You know, like they'd say, kid, grow up, or, you know, whatever it would be.
That's true.
So what I did is I created a character who at that point seemed vastly old to me. He was in his mid-50s. And he was a burnt-out Israeli spy.
Mm-hmm.
And that book, I would say, that character had what I imagined the feelings I was having at 24 would be like for someone who was in their 50s and burnt out. But after that, you know, I think I've stolen from more people other than myself. In other words, I don't think these other characters in the spies gamble. I remember once someone, you know, way back when they were reading the Damascus cover said to me, you know, I started listening to it and it sounded like you. But after a certain number of pages, it sounded like a book. You know, it made that transition.
Yeah,
but I don't think there's, like in the spies gamble, I don't think there's anybody there that's really
you.
Me. You know, I think they're just, they are sometimes amalgams of people I've met.
Right.
You know, and put together.
Yeah. I think that we all do that.
Right. Although I would say, for example, I don't know if I've ever said, if I've said this much, but in four of these five novels, or three of these novels, there's another one called To Destroy Jerusalem that also has the same characters. There's a Palestinian character, Ramzi Awad, who they come to all these books. And it turns out he's based on a real Palestinian. He was a PLO fighter, terrorist, whatever language you want to use. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, he was a short story writer. And he was very, he is very famous in the Palestinian world, even though the Israelis blew him up in a car bomb in 72 with his niece in Beirut for a reason. At that point, they had set the Japanese terrorists into the Tel Aviv airport, the Lod airport massacre. I think it was in the early 80s. I'm not sure about that at the moment. And what they did is they went in and they hid machine guns in violin cases and cello cases and opened fire in the arrivals lounge. It was in the days before that started.
Yeah, checking double, triple security.
And hand luggage, which didn't happen before. And this guy was the spokesman for the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which did this event, so the Israelis blew him up. I don't have any trouble with that particularly. But I thought, what an interesting character who was a fighter who also wrote short stories that were known throughout. When I go into the old city of Jerusalem or the Palestinian refugee camps, his work is known all these years. So I made a character who was just not as radical, who would be sort of more of a mainline Palestinian and who was a writer. And it's carried me through a few books.
Okay.
That's really interesting.
We're going to,
I have another question.
Hold it until after,
question,
our break.
Jim? Yeah.
No, we have a break coming up.
Oh, okay. I'll hold it.
So don't go away. You don't go away. Bob, I know you're not going to go away.
I've got headphones on. I can't get too
you
far.
Can't. Yeah, nobody can go anywhere. So hang tough. Bobby Jean, would you like to pull out your head and give us a little tingle?
Sure.
Go for it.
This is the time of year we reach for a warm, cozy blanket. A blanket that gets better with time. And Out West is your source for the Cadillac of blankets, the Denali collection. Softer and warmer than fleece, these unique blankets are made from an innovative fabric called microplush. And Denali has patterns and designs for any home decor style. You provide the fire, the book, and your favorite hot beverage. Out West provides the blanket. Come on over to outwestshop.com to find the perfect cozy throw for your long winter nap. Use coupon code BLANKET and save $10 off your order of $75 or more. Call toll-free 1-877-340-9378, and it's always a great day out West.
It is a good day out West. Okay. Imagine deep blue skies, majestic mountains, and acres of lush green orange trees in a tranquil country-like setting. Sound like a perfect vacation spot? It is, for your dog. That's right. All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepover is the premium place for your four-legged friends to spend their time away from you. Whether you are going away for a one- or two-night getaway or an extended vacation, All Dogs Rule is the place your dog wants to be when they can't be with you. So when your dog returns home, you'll have to ask, whose vacation was better? Well, we know the answer to that, the dogs. Well, you're turned off. Check out their website at alldogsrule.com or give them a call at 805-524-1100. Your dog will thank you, and Russ and Karen will thank you, and everybody will be happy, and so will your dog. Okay. When Creative Edge Publicity was founded in 2016, they immediately showed they weren't the same as other publicity firms. They work closely with their individual clients and needs and goals and push harder to get them noticed. Creative Edge believes that communication is an important part of the partnership, and that model is how they have built their success. They collaborate and work with local, national, and international media outlets and organizations to meet clients' goals. So Creative Edge is your brand and your future. So get a hold of them. They're on the web. Just go to Creative Edge, do a search, Creative Edge Publicity, and you'll get there, and you can contact Mickey Mickelson, and he will be more than happy to talk to you about your goals and your dreams. Bob, you're Creative Edge, right?
I am.
Yeah, you belong to Mickey. You're a Mickey's,
right. Yeah,
Mickey's person.
I'm one of Mickey's clients.
Yeah. Okay, it is now 7:34. We are in the studio with, of course, Bob Brill and Howard Kaplan, our guest for tonight. Bobby Jean is on the phone. And I have to say, I'm looking at this stack of wallet over here that Bob has got his phone propped on. I have no idea how he even gets that in his pocket. It is like 4 inches thick.
Yeah, I know.
It's. I mean, talk about somebody who's going to have back problems.
I already do.
Crap,
do yeah.
Wow.
That's why, you know, I have taken to wearing a sweatshirt most of the time instead of a jacket. And I usually carry my wallet in my...
In your front pocket?
In the front. Well, in the
sweatshirt. Oh, in your... Yeah.
In the sweatshirt, yeah. Yeah.
Lucky you.
Yeah.
Anyway... Welcome back, Howard. I'm sorry?
There's no money in it, by the way.
Well, yeah, you're married. I know that's the truth. Anyway, the name of your book is Spies Gamble. It's available on Amazon. I just saw it there. And right. All the online booksellers.
Right.
And along with 4 other novels, all of the same ilk, primarily. Let's roll over to your writing style now, because you have a distinctive style. And I don't know, can't put my finger on it. It's just, you use a lot of dialogue, but you use a lot of description.
Mm-hmm. I've always, in fact, I'll tell you how the description came about. When I sold, I'd been to Damascus briefly, but not enough, I wasn't there long enough to describe the city. I was there long enough to get a feel for it. And I wrote this novel, and it was sold to Dutton. And I go to New York, I meet the editor, and he hands me a book called Harry's Game by an author named Gerald Seymour, which is about Northern Ireland. He says, this book smells, tastes, feels like Northern Ireland. I want you to do this with Damascus.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what the first draft was like, or the draft that they bought was mm-hmm. like. So I went back. I wrote to the Syrian Ministry of Tourism in Damascus. They sent me a huge map. I put it on my wall. Thank God for the Brits. They've been everywhere. And they wrote memoirs about it. And between the map and the books and what I'd seen and anything else I could read, I started to recreate Damascus. And, you know, who knew at that point that the book would be an artifact for what Syria was like prior to the Civil War?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the city was untainted there. Damascus is actually the oldest continuously inhabited city on earth because it's an oasis. Rivers come up from Lebanon,
mm-hmm.
and you go to Damascus, it's rung with fruit trees. Every kind of tree and nut tree you can imagine. So from that initial experience, it became a kind of signature for me. That everywhere I went that I thought I was writing about, I would take detailed notes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would find that I would get a lot of feedback, Bobby, both from what you're saying. People really liked the history. They wanted to learn things through the vehicle of a suspense novel, a spy novel. And they also liked the locale.
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while, I get someone who says, the description slowed down the story for me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's fine. Everybody has, you know, that mm-hmm. everybody has something.
Yeah,
but
we've all learned to deal with critics.
Right. You just say, thank you, and, you know, buy the next book.
Yeah.
So I've done it everywhere. So when I go into a refugee camp in the West Bank, I take notes. I take pictures, too, but basically it's notes, because if I take notes, I'm closer to the what I'm going to be writing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If I take pictures, I'm sort of like starting all over. And I mm-hmm. listen to the stories I'm told. Like, for example, as I was taken with Palestinians through the refugee camp in Ramallah, they told me that sometimes the soldiers come in to look for weapons. So this is the difficult. How do you look at both sides? On one side, the Israelis don't want to be shot at, so they go in and look for illegal weapons. On the Palestinian side, they don't want people barging into their refugee camp and into their homes at night, you know, looking for weapons. Yeah. So one of their defenses is to throw small refrigerators down from the rooftops onto the patrolling Israeli soldiers. So when I heard that from the Palestinians, I ended up writing it from the other side, which is, how does it feel to be an Israeli patrolling that refugee camp with the danger that a refrigerator could come down on him at any moment? So I ended up liking this lesson, this early lesson I got from this editor about Northern Ireland, and that's what I've done ever since.
Can you imagine the conversations of Israeli soldiers as their as refrigerators are raining down upon them?
And you guys, well, I don't think it's a lot. I think it's more like one.
One is enough.
Yes, but it's, you know, and remember that these are 18 and 19 year old kids, Israeli soldiers.
Yeah,
this isn't
a
battle hardened, you know, tank division.
These
are current conscripts whose job is, and nobody wants to patrol a refugee camp.
Well, yeah, I can see that. You know, I wouldn't either.
Yeah, you're always looking up.
Yeah, I know. Huh? it's, you know, what was that? A refrigerator.
Yeah, a small refrigerator. You know, 18 inches by 18 inches, but it's still metal and it's still a refrigerator.
Right, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
It's that size.
Yeah.
And it's coming down from two stories.
So are you working on anything now?
Well, I have this other book that actually I came out subsequently called To Destroy Jerusalem.
Okay.
It's the same characters, but it's set earlier in 1990 during the first Palestinian uprising.
So and it's a prequel.
It's a prequel.
Okay.
And they can all be read in any order.
Oh,
They're all separate. And the first Palestinian uprising was marked by huge organization, strike days. And so they would, you know, set out, they would post the strike instructions. They would paint them on the walls, you know, with lettering. So then the Israelis would come by, because this is part of what occupation is, and make them take paint and paint over it. And then they do it again. So I thought it and I happened to have been there at that time, and I had a lot of notes and material. And I wanted to, you know, these are tragically missed opportunities in the Middle East. And without blaming either side, there were just a lot of opportunities everywhere that were not realized. And we're in this mess. I wrote an op-ed in the LA Times in 1987 that said, if you continue in the direction we're going, Israel will be a permanently besieged fortress. And not much has changed. And that's why even my old books seem to sell well, because, you know, I was talking that way in the 80s and nothing improved.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, quite the opposite. I think in The Spy's Gamble I talked about that, how, for example, when I was a student at the Hebrew University in the 70s, you could go up to the Temple Mount.
Right.
It was open all the time. There was one little guard there. Now there's a fence. It's closed to tourists and Israelis except for twice a day. There's a prescribed hour where you can go up to the Temple Mount.
Hmm.
Because they're afraid of demonstrations and bottle throwing and Molotov cocktail throwing. And the simplest way for me to describe that is it's a result of failures to find a solution, you know, on all sides. I just was looking at some old notes. I met an Egyptian architect, a very famous guy named Hassan Fati, in Cairo in the 70s. He said it's ridiculous that they can't get together and find a solution, and nobody really has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to me that there's always some way to stop a problem, just that some people just don't want to do it.
Well, you've got two sides that they both want something and they're not going to budge.
Well, this is the problem with their heads.
And everybody
nothing
loses.
Is getting
but,
in.
But you have to realize this goes back to the beginning of time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it goes back to, you know, what, I don't know.
Time immemorial.
Yeah, I mean. When time when you had Judah and the rest of Israel and all the other countries around,
right?
You know, at the same time, you know, and it's, and then you've had every country in the world from the Crusades to, you know, Christianity and everything else. Everybody wants Jerusalem,
right?
And not everybody.
Well, that's because it's the center of the ancient world.
Yep.
So, Bobby, you want to ask the question?
Sure.
We're running out of time.
This program is called The Writer's Block, and so we love to have our guests tell us, do you experience writer's block? If so, how do you get around it? Do you not believe in it? Tell us your take on
I was very fortunate in my life that when I was 23, I met a writer named Michael Blankfort, who was 65. Now, his name isn't known, but everybody knows his work. He wrote The Caine Mutiny.
Oh, well.
Oh yeah, okay.
The screen version. It was a Herman Wolk novel.
Right.
He wrote a film called Adam Had Four Sons with Ingrid Bergman. In fact, there's a great story about him. He wrote a novel called, he wrote 14 novels and dozens of screenplays.
Wow.
So he wrote a novel called The Brave and the Blind about the Spanish Civil War. It was given to Hemingway to review for Time magazine, and Hemingway trashed it. Why? Because For Whom the Bell Tolls hadn't come out yet. for real.
Yeah.
And then there's a story, not a real story. Blankfort was in the Stork Club with Ingrid Bergman, and he was a young novelist, and in comes Hemingway. And Blankfort's going to get up and deck him, you know, or do whatever you do when you hit Hemingway. Hemingway comes up and says, Blankfort, I need to apologize to you. Your novel's great. It's better than mine. So Hemingway went on two extremes. You know, first he said the book is better, you know, trash, and then he said it's better than mine. And he said, I didn't want it. He goes, what's the Swede drinking? And they drank. So I met Blankfort, and he looked at all my early work. And when he said writer's block, here's what he told me. He said, you sit at your typewriter in those days, and you type your name over and over until you have something more to say. You don't sit and you don't walk. And I remember that to this day.
Wow, I have never heard that one. There's one for the books, Bonnie.
Right. Oh, Bobby, that's great.
Fred, George, whatever your name is.
Okay.
Cool.
And that's how I learned. And so I learned that, you know, I think block is mostly fear.
Yeah, or lazy.
You know, and I think that,
or
you know,
focus.
The time, you know, what I do sometimes is when I need an idea, I ride my bike around.
Yeah.
Just to sort of keep myself busy and not sit there, not turn the TV on.
Yeah, we call it writer's pause.
So those are the two things I learned early on.
Cool. You know, I would love to talk more about it. I would love to get into your Damascus cover and all that, but we're out of time.
Well,
it's what happens when the guest is good and you sit here and you, wow, it's gone. It's gone. So I thank you so much for braving L.A. and coming and visiting us here in Sherman Oaks and on the 36th floor of the Sherman Oaks Tower overlooking the high school. I know. Bob loves
high,
that.
High atop the studio.
High atop the studio.
Writer's Block Building.
Writer's Block Building in good old downtown Sherman Oaks, California.
It used to be WB, but we can't use that.
That's right. That's right. We do that. Yeah. And yeah. That's a Notre Dame High School's right there.
You go.
You can see
right
it. That's right there.
Next
anyway,
to the gas station that sells the.
Howard Kaplan, your books are available on Amazon, again, all the online booksellers. Are there any hard copies available in like just brick and mortar stores?
Some of the old books, they're paperbacks everywhere.
Sure.
And the Damascus cover was originally a hardcover, and it had a pretty good press run. So there's still, I remember being at the Strand bookstore in New York, and the guy said, and I saw like rows of them. And I said, oh God, you know.
That's got to be a great feeling though, right?
What? But it turns out I was, you know, as many times in my life, I was completely wrong. He says, no, that's terrific. That means your publisher sent out a whole lot of review copies.
Right.
And that's, you know, who sends them back in.
Right.
The reviewers. Mm-hmm. So those copies, you know, are still around. They can be found. And the paperback is the film is on Hulu at the moment.
Right. That's where I've got it queued up, so I'm going to watch
it
this weekend.
Right, and so there's a new paperback cover with John Hurt and Jonathan Rhys Meyers that looks really good. They designed it really nicely.
Huh.
And in the new world, you can just digitally slap the... It's on the Kindle, too, Nook
okay.
and the other stuff, the same cover.
Were you involved in writing the screenplay or no?
No, I was involved in the editing, funny enough, mm-hmm. post the film. They actually, when they were editing it, they said, oops, you know, maybe we need a little help. And they came, you know, I'm in L.A., so they came to me with a Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And I said, well, let's cut out 10 of the first 12 minutes, and that will help.
Yeah. You know, it's that book had to have been optioned for a long time before it finally got made into a film.
Well, it was, you know, it was dead for a long time, and then it was optioned in 2005.
Wow.
And it took 10 years to get it done. It's all about money, as everybody
knows. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, when you have enough money, you can hire anybody.
That's Hollywood.
Right. Or you get a good script and you can hire people inexpensively. Right. But you have to have a certain amount of money. And it's actually a $5 million film. It looks like a $25 million film. It was shot in Morocco, primarily.
Yeah.
And Morocco has a big film industry.
I think they do now, yeah.
You know, and all the Hollywood Middle East films, or even Beirut, was shot in Morocco. Babel.
Yeah. Okay, Howard Kaplan, do you want to let our listeners know your contact information?
I can be found in a lot of places on Facebook. You know, I have a personal page and an author page, and I answer. And I have a website that's howardkaplanauthor.com.
Right.
Howard Kaplan was taken.
Oh, how could that happen?
Too common of a name.
I know, huh?
So somebody came up with howardkaplanauthor.com.
Excellent. Well, next week we have Peter James on. We actually are pre-recording that show on Monday because, of course, Peter is in London. And if we record at 7 o'clock on Pacific time, it's like 3 o'clock in the morning. And he just decided
he, ain't gonna
be there. He wasn't going to be a happy camper. So we're gonna give him a shot on Monday, but that will be airing on Thursday at 7. And we're also doing a special writer's block on Tuesday night with Samantha Brown and her magazine that she does online for her high school. So that ought to be fun. And then I think we're going to probably be booking an extra show again this year up through June for Junie Fisher, who wants very much to be on the show.
Excellent.
So I think we'll give her an extra night.
Great.
Huh?
That's
well,
great.
I know. You were just like, you know, you're like worried your friend Junie wasn't going to make it. So I figured, what the hell? I'm doing it for an 18-year-old. I can do it for Junie Fisher. So anyway.
Awesome.
For Howard, thank you so much.
Thank
Bob,
you, guys.
Always a pleasure. Always and we'll time. See you next week. Oh, and actually, I won't.
No.
Next week is Russ's week, and right. I'll see him Monday morning. And Bobby Jean, we'll talk to you guys the week after. And
right.
For myself, Jim Christina, and the Writer's Block television show. Good God almighty.
Make it ahead, Jimmy.
And we are out of here.